Lecture 6, Financial Investment from the Supply Side.
In this lecture, we want to continue the discussion of capital markets that we began in the previous lecture. Previous lecture, of course, we laid out the ideas of supply and demand as they apply to capital markets and introduced ideas like the time value of money and present discounted value. What we want to do in this lecture is look at the supply side of capital markets. That is, people putting money into the market, investing it, and trying to make money for themselves. Now, of course, when we think about the supply side of capital markets, one fundamental question comes to mind for all of us right away, and that is, can I get rich? And if so, how? Tell me in this lecture. The short answer to that question is, yes, you can get rich. The magic words to understand in thinking about that are compound interest. What do we mean by compound interest exactly? I'm sure most people have heard the term, but some people don't have a firm grip on what it means. Compound interest simply refers to earning interest on interest. So, for example, if you started off with $1 and you invested it at 10% interest, at the end of the year you'd have $1.10. But if you just let that money ride, left it in the bank, left it in whatever account it was in, that at the end of the second year you don't have $1.20, another 10 cents, what you have is $1.21. Because you have 10% interest earned on $1.10, you earn interest on the interest that you had after the first year. Now, this is the sort of example which I think qualifies as sort of big whoop-de-doo. I have an extra penny. But that effect of earning interest on interest makes a substantial difference if we look over long periods of time and if we look over larger sums of money. There's an official formula for this which it's useful to have in mind. The formula will appear both in your book, in the booklets that come with the lecture, and if you're looking at the video version, it's on screen. The formula is that you take the present value of what you're investing, in this case, say $1, you multiply it times 1 plus the interest rate, and you raise that to the power t, where t is the number of years you're investing in, and what you get at the end is the future value, how much that money will accumulate over time. So essentially that tells you that if you were investing, you're getting a certain amount of interest, it compounds year after year after year, and it adds up to whatever amount that will be at the very end. Now, to illustrate the power of compound interest, perhaps the best way to think about it is to think about how some different interest rates provide different amounts of money over different periods of time. Let's start off with sort of a low interest rate, say about 5% a year. And at 5% a year, if you put, say, $1,000 aside, and you get 5% interest over 10 years, that would accumulate out over those 10 years to $1,628. So that's sort of a hefty gain. That's a gain of about, 62% over those 10 years. If you put that money aside, or you just left it in that account for 25 years at 5% interest, you would have almost $3,400. And if you left it in that same account at that same rate of interest for 40 years, it would add up to $7,000, or multiply out, I guess is the right term. So you think about that. If you put $1,000 aside at 5% and you let it sit for 40 years, it multiplies by a factor of 7. Now, that 40-year horizon is not just arbitrary. If you think about it, 40 years is not an unreasonable amount of time from, say, age 25 until retirement at 65, or age 30 to retirement at 70, or age 35 to retirement at 75. In other words, that 40-year horizon is fairly reasonable if you're thinking about putting aside money young, early in your life, for retirement later on. Now, how about if we get a slightly higher interest rate, something like 10% interest rate? Well, if we had a 10% interest rate, and we put money aside, $1,000 aside, for 10 years, after 10 years, that would be $2,600. After 25 years, it works out to almost $11,000. And after 40 years, at a 10% interest rate, your original $1,000 would be more than $45,000. It would multiply by a factor of 45. Now, that's, I think, a fairly extraordinary number. But let's bump it up just a little higher to get a real notion for how compound interest can work. Say that you can get a 15% rate of return. And if you put your money in the stock market over a long period of time, a nominal return of 15% is not an unreasonable sort of return to have. If you let that money ride for 10 years, the original $1,000 would work out to $4,000, more or less, a little bit more. After 25 years, it would work out to $33,000. And after 40 years, at a 15% annual rate of return, your original $1,000 would compound out to what's to me an unbelievable number, $267,863. Now that, remember, is from an original $1,000 stake. So yeah, you can be rich. You can be rich if you put your money aside, you let it ride, and you let the magic of compound interest work for you. Albert Einstein is once quoted as having said, although this may be one of those stories which is not really true, is once quoted as having said that he was asked what the most powerful force in the universe was. And of course, with Einstein, you would think there'd be some learned answer about matter and energy and all those kinds of things. And Einstein said the most powerful force in the universe is compound interest. And it is extraordinarily powerful. Compound interest is what allows me to say with some confidence that even though I've certainly not been an incredibly well-paid lawyer, investment banker, I've had academic jobs all of my life, that by the time I'm 50, I will be a millionaire. I'll be a millionaire not because of anything special I've done, but just because at about age 23, I started putting away about 10% of my salary every year in a way which, as it accumulates over time, will multiply out to about that number. It's no magic to it. It's just how the magic of mathematics works out. At about this point, people sometimes say something like, well, this isn't quite what I meant. When I said I wanted to be a millionaire, I didn't mean I wanted to be a millionaire when I was 50 or when I was 60. I would say I want to be a millionaire now, or I want to be a millionaire a year from now or 2 years from now. Well, in that case, there's not a heck of a lot of advice that I can give you or that anyone can give you, I think. You can always listen to the people on late night television and try and follow some of their advice. But I don't think there's any guarantees about getting rich in a year or two. All I'm promising is that you can be rich over time if you save up gradually and slowly and if you put aside the money. If you are listening to these lectures and you're someone who's in their mid-60s and you're saying, I haven't saved anything, how do I make up for that at this point in my life? The answer is that by the mid-60s, it's really kind of late to be starting. You want to start as early as possible and save as much as possible as early as you can. Well, how do you save this money? How do you put it aside? What should you put it in? Well, before thinking about that question of specific investments you could put things in, let me talk instead about what we care about when we're looking at investments. What are the characteristics of investments that ought to matter when you're trying to distinguish between one investment and another? There are really four factors that matter. The first one, of course, is return. You care about how much is it going to pay, real return, and how much you're going to get in terms of compound interest. Second factor that matters is risk. And risk is something people don't always take into account, but they certainly should. When you think about what the return is likely to be, some things may be a high return or look like a high return because they're very risky. But they may actually turn out to be zero or a low return at the end of the day. So one thing you want to think about is how much risk am I taking on? And think to yourself, other things equal, if I can get the same return doing something else, then more risk is not worth taking. The only reason to take risk, presumably, is if it's going to pay off somehow, if you're going to get a higher return because of it. A third thing we would care about in any investment is its liquidity. Liquidity is the term that economists and finance people use for how easy is it to sell. Some things are very easy to sell. For example, if you have a bank account, it's really easy to go take your money out of that bank account. That's a very liquid way to have your money. On the other hand, if you own a car, well, you can sell a car, but it takes a little more time and energy. It's a little bit less liquid. If you own a house, it may take you months to sell it. And so when we think about liquidity, things are worth more to you if they're relatively easy to sell. If they're somewhat harder to sell, they take time and energy and money to sell, then you would expect it to be worth somewhat less to you. A fourth factor that we care about when we're thinking about any kind of investment is tax breaks. Some things have special tax status. Some things are exempt from federal tax altogether. For example, state and local bonds are often exempt from federal income tax, so you just don't pay tax on the interest you earn there. Other things can serve as a tax deduction for you. For example, if you own a house, the interest that you pay on your home mortgage, the borrowing you did from the bank, is deductible from the income that you pay tax on. Or, in other cases, some tax breaks are just that the gains are deferred over a period of time. You don't have to pay the tax until later. A standard example of something like that would be the capital gains tax. If you have something which increases in value over time, you do have to pay tax on that increase in value, but you don't have to pay the tax until you actually decide to sell whatever it is. Now, the fact that you can put off the tax and postpone it into the future is a tax break. Because as we discussed in the previous lecture, the time value of money means that if you don't have to pay the tax now, you can pay it 5 years from now or 10 years from now, you're definitely better off than you otherwise were. Putting off something into the future is a way of saving money. So with any investment, you want to take these four factors into account: return, risk, liquidity, and whether or not there are any special tax breaks associated with it. Now, what I want to do is take those four factors and sort of hold them in the back of your mind as four factors to think about and that you ought to be paying attention to. And then let's think about individual investments that people can actually choose and think about how they fit in on this hierarchy of these different kinds of trade-offs. And I'll say in advance that for me personally, and I think for most people, the really big trade-off that people care about is really risk versus return. Do we want to take high risk and maybe get high return and maybe not? Or do we want to take low risk and really have a pretty low return as a result? Well, let's start at the low risk, low return end of things. A very, very simple investment would be a bank account. I assume everybody's familiar with what a bank account is. But in terms of our four categories, it's worth saying it's a very low return investment. Bank accounts now are often paying 2 or 3% interest, something like that. It's also a really, really safe investment, because the federal government guarantees how much the money you put in. So you really have no way of losing your money unless you've got a large amount invested. It's very liquid. You can get to it very easily. That's another reason it pays a low return. And you do have to pay tax on the interest. So there's no special break in terms of the interest payments. So pretty much this is your dull as ditch water, low interest, not very exciting kind of investment. A few years ago, a fellow named Burton Malkiel wrote a book called A Random Walk Down Wall Street. And I'll, in a little bit in this lecture, I'll come back and talk more about what he means by a random walk down Wall Street. But in this book, Malkiel draws up what he calls the sleeping scale of major investment choices. And when he talks about the sleeping scale, what he's really saying is, if you have all your money invested in this particular investment, how soundly do you sleep at night? That's a way of sort of gauging risk, I guess. So with bank accounts, according to the sleeping scale that Burton Malkiel develops, he says that on the sleeping scale, this is what we would call a semi-comatose state. If your money is all in bank accounts, you might as well be in a coma. I mean, there's zero to worry about. So on the sleeping scale, this is an extremely safe investment. A second investment, moving a little bit up, a little more risk, a little more return, would be something called a money market fund. A money market fund, again, is one of those sort of intimidating terms which isn't all that complicated in practice. All we mean by a money market fund is a fund where the money that people put into the fund is invested in bonds, typically in federal government bonds. And we talked about what bonds were in the previous lecture. Since it's invested in bonds, it pays a slightly higher rate of interest than the bank accounts. Often now you might be able to get 4 or 5% in a money market fund rather than the 2 or 3% in a bank account. However, money market funds are sometimes not quite as liquid. There can be requirements, for example, that if you write a check on your money market fund, it has to be for a certain minimum amount, maybe $500 or something like that. Or there may be some limits on how quickly you can get the money, that you can't just go to an automatic teller machine and take the money out in that way. It's a very little bit riskier than a bank account because it's not explicitly federally guaranteed. On the other hand, because they're buying government bonds, and you figure the U.S. government is not likely to default on its bonds, there's really not a heck of a lot of risk there. So you get a little bit more risk, a little bit higher return. And if we look at Burton Malkiel's scale for the sleeping scale, he says that if you've got your money in money market accounts, on the sleeping scale, this would be you can have long afternoon naps and a sound night's sleep. Not quite comatose, but darn comfortable from a sleep point of view. So, moving again, just a little bit up the ladder, a next step would be to think about certificates of deposit. A certificate of deposit is the situation where you put your money in an account, it's locked in, and it stays there for a certain period of time. Maybe 6 months, maybe a year, maybe 2 years. Obviously, the difficulty with them from a person's point of view is that they're not liquid. Once you put the money in there, you've locked it in. And as they say, when you buy a certificate of deposit or a CD, there is a, quote, substantial penalty for early withdrawal. And so pretty much what that penalty means is you lose the interest.
You still get your money back, but you lose the interest. Certificates of deposit are not federally insured. However, typically, again, they're invested in quite safe ways. That's not always true, but it's usually true. And so, as a result, you get a little bit of extra interest for giving up on liquidity and locking the money in. On Mochel's sleeping scale, if you've got your money in 6-month certificates or something like that, he would say that's where you have just a sound night's sleep. You might lose your long afternoon naps, but you've still got a sound night's sleep. Moving again, just a little bit up the ladder, something that's a little bit more risky, would be to turn to corporate bonds. Now, if you're buying bonds, for reasons that I'll come back to in a little bit, I'm going to steer away from the question of trying to pick out one particular company and buy their particular bonds, and say that what you do instead is you buy a big diversified group of corporate bonds. So you buy basically a fund, a mutual fund, which invests its money in the bonds of many different companies. Now, the advantage of doing that, from your point of view, of course, is that you don't know, presumably, a heck of a lot about a whole lot of different companies. And investigating all the different companies and figuring out which ones are more likely to pay their bonds, which ones are less likely to pay their bonds, is going to take a lot of time and energy. It's much easier to simply buy a fund which invests in many, many of these bonds. And then, if a few of them go broke or a few of them don't make money, well, you know, you've got lots of others. You're not all tied up. You don't have all your eggs in one basket. So let's think about a mutual fund that invests in bonds. Again, some of the companies in that fund may not pay the interest rates, but the odds are that most of them will over a period of time. Mutual funds are not ultra-liquid use most of the time, but you can write in or write checks or call up, and they'll send you a check within a few days. So they're relatively easy to cash in. The real risk, if you think about corporate bonds and that sort of thing, is not so much what happens with the companies, but it's what happens with interest rates in general. Imagine, for example, that you have invested in a mutual fund and that company bought bonds of a whole lot of different companies. And let's say that those bonds typically pay, just to choose a number out of the air, 6% a year. Now, that 6% might look pretty good right now. But remember that what can happen with interest rates is they may go up, the nominal rate may go real way up, even though the real rate doesn't go up. Imagine, for example, that a year later, the nominal interest rate that's out there is 10%, and the inflation rate has gone up to, say, 7%. Well, you were locked into your bond fund. You bought all these bonds that were only paying 6%, and now with an inflation rate of 7%, your real rate of return is going to be negative. So when you think about investing in bonds, your real worry is that nominal interest rates may be moving up and down in a way which is going to put your original investment at risk. Of course, the other thing could happen as well. You might actually feel better off if what happened was other interest rates went down. Then you would have locked in this 6% rate. You'd be feeling pretty good about that. And if other interest rates went down to 3 or 4%, then you would be feeling pretty good. You'd be getting higher than was otherwise available to you in the market. So the real risk when you turn to corporate bonds is not whether or not the company itself goes broke. The real risk is what happens to overall interest rates in the economy. According to Burton Malkiel's sleeping scale, if you put all your money in a diversified portfolio of bonds, he says, well, now what we're talking about is some tossing and turning, an occasional dream or two, and some possibly unpleasant dreams. We're beginning to take on just a little more risk. Step up the scale. Little more risk, little more return. Let's think now about a mutual fund which is invested in what might be called blue chip stocks. And by blue chip stocks, I mean well-established, large companies which have a long-term record of making a good amount of money. Now, of course, there is some risk whenever you start investing in stocks. Many people remember, for example, the stock market crash of 1987 or more recent stock market ups and downs, where the entire market may go down 10, 15, 20% in a single day. If you have your money invested in a fund which has all its money in stocks, then you're really looking at a situation where you could lose 10, 15, 20% of your investment in a single day. Now, that's a significant amount of risk. Over the long term, the risk may not be as great because things have a tendency to bounce back and even out. But nonetheless, there's more risk there than you might be comfortable taking right off the bat. Often with blue chip stocks and mutual funds, the gains that come into that fund are gains because the stock price got higher and higher. However, you don't have to pay tax on those gains until the stock is actually sold. And so you have that ability to defer the tax through the capital gains tax break. And these are fairly liquid. If you're in a portfolio of blue chip stocks, you can get probably about an 8 or 9% real return. And that's a darn good real return. With inflation on top of that, the nominal return will be even higher. So in Bert Malkiel's description of his sleeping scale, he says that if you're investing in a diversified portfolio of blue chip stocks, now the sleeping scale says some tossing and turning before you doze and vivid dreams before awakening. We're beginning to get into the world where you pay a little more attention to what happens in the Wall Street Journal on a given day. One more step up the risk ladder would be, instead of investing in a mutual fund which invests in big, solid, stable companies, think about investing in a mutual fund which invests in what they might call growth stocks. Growth stock is the optimistic name for small, not very established company, which we sure hope is going to do well. Now again, remember that you're buying stock in a whole range of these companies through the mutual fund. You're not trying to pick out individual ones. So as a result of that, you don't have to say, this particular company in some far-off state is going to do well. All you have to say is, on average, out of this large group of companies, there will be some winners. There's still more risk if you do this, because now you're talking about small companies that aren't very well established. However, it's still a fairly liquid investment. Things are moving along pretty well. And as a result of taking slightly more risk, the odds are that a few of these companies will pay off big time, and you'll be able to make more money over the long run, even if you have more up and down volatility and risk in the short run. Malkiel says, if you invest in a diversified portfolio of risky stocks, such as aggressive, growth-oriented mutual funds, then the sleeping scale says, nightmares are not uncommon, but over the long run, you'll be well-rested. Two more sets of investments that people often talk about. One would be an investment in real estate. You hear a lot of people say that the investment in your house is for a lot of people, their single biggest investment. There used to be even a proverb about this. People would talk about something being as safe as houses. Well, people don't so much use that proverb anymore. I have too many friends in Southern California, in Texas, in New York, in Washington, D.C., who bought houses 5-6 years ago and have seen the values go up and down and up and down, some of whom saw their down payment wiped out because the value of the home dropped so much that they ended up having to sell at a loss and not even get the down payment back. So real estate is certainly somewhat risky. There's no question about it. In the big picture, one of the images that you have to have about the real estate market is to think about the baby boom generation. That is, those folks born in the decade or so after World War II. Those folks were sort of getting to home buying age in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And as they entered the market in force, they all came into the market and were interested in buying houses. So in the 70s and then going into the early 80s, there were a whole lot of home buyers entering the market. And you would expect demand for houses to be fairly high. As a result of that, high demand for houses, lots of people pouring into the market, that's one of the reasons why housing prices went up so rapidly through most of the 70s and into the 80s. But the baby boom generation tailed off. By the late 80s and the early 90s, it's not clear that there's another big group of baby boomers coming along to buy a whole lot of houses. Demand for housing is off a little bit. Not in a huge way, but it's certainly not what it was back in the late 60s and early 70s. As a result, what I say to my friends, if you're thinking about buying a house today, I say, well, go ahead and buy it if you want. But don't buy the house as a financial investment. Don't buy it expecting to make a lot of money out of it. Buy it because you want to live in it. Buy it because there's some internal value to you in using the house and in living in the house and in owning the space around you. And if you want to, you know, own the space around you, that's just fine. That's a perfectly good reason to buy a house. But it's not a reason which says, rush right out there. You have to buy a house now. And that's the advice people used to get. The advice people commonly got was, when you're as young as possible, get right out there, buy a house as soon as possible, buy as much house as you can, because housing prices are only going up, and you need to start buying now. If you took that advice in the last 5 or 10 years, you probably did not do very well with it. And I don't see any particular reason to think you'll do particularly well with that kind of advice in the next 10, 20 years. I don't think people lose a lot of money in housing. You know, it'll probably do just fine over time. But it's not a place to make a heck of a lot of money. And investing in real estate, because it's not very liquid, can be a really hazardous place to be. On the sleeping scale of Burton Malkiel, we're now talking about vivid dreams and occasional nightmares if you invest your money in housing. And then a final set of investments we can sort of think of as gold, precious metals, collectibles, baseball cards, fine art, all those sorts of odds and ends that you hear about people buying. People buy a baseball card, Honus Wagner, from the early 20th century for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it sounds like there are real gains to be made there. But, of course, the truth of the matter is that when you start investing in those kinds of things, boy, you're really taking a gamble. You might do very, very well. And there are certain times and certain time periods and certain investments when people have done very, very well. But they're for people who have a real taste for taking some risk. You may also do just terribly. According to Malkiel's sleeping scale, if you have your money in gold, you should be ready for bouts of insomnia. You're not going to sleep real well if your money's in something which can be leaping up and down quite that much. So when we think about investments, we think about the range of investments. The real question you need to think about is, given where I am in the world, what sort of risks am I willing to take? What sort of liquidity do I need? What are my time horizons? Am I looking a long way into the future? Am I looking a short way into the future? And people sort of say, what's the best investment? And the honest truth is that there's not a single best investment out there for everybody. That's not how investing works. The real question you need to think about is, what's the right balance for you in terms of matching up this range of investments to your range of possibilities? It's actually not quite as complicated as it might sound, though. And this was, to me, sort of an interesting insight from when I studied finance a few years back. Let's think about how much risk you're willing to take. And let's take, at one end, quite risky investment, investing in a mutual fund of growth stocks or something like that, where there's a lot of risk involved. And let's take, at the other end, a very safe investment, a bank account. Now, let's think about someone who wants to take a certain amount of risk. If they don't want to take any risk at all, they put all their money in the bank account. That's completely safe. If they want to take lots and lots of risk, they put all their money in the mutual fund of growth stocks. Now, the interesting thought is that if you're somewhere in between those extremes, all you need to do is adjust what the percentages are of money in those two investments. For example, if you're very safe, you want to take a little more risk, well, put 90% of your money in the bank account and 10% in the mutual fund of growth stocks. A little more risk, 80% in the bank account, 20% in the mutual fund of growth stocks. So when you're thinking about these kinds of investments, you don't have to go out there and have a little bit invested in every category. You don't have to have a bank account and a CD and a money market fund and a bond fund and a stock fund and a this and a that and the other. That's just not necessary. All you need to do is think about something that's risky and something that's safe, and then think about choosing the proportion in between those two things which fits where you are and fits how much risk you want to take and fits where you are in your life. Now, if you think about it in that way, I think for a lot of people, it makes the whole thing seem a whole lot simpler. You're no longer worrying about trying to pick everything in the world. You just need to think about, for you personally, what's the balance that makes sense. Now, when we think about this business of time horizons and what makes sense, I guess what I would say is that, you know, money that you need right now or that you might need in the next couple months, that's money which I sort of think of as grocery money. Grocery money you should have available to you. You know, put it in the bank. At most, put it in a money market kind of mutual fund. But keep it very liquid, because you don't want to be in a situation where you have to pay the bills next month and the stock market goes down and all of a sudden you're 20% short. That's just not a good way to live, at least not if you believe in the sleeping scale and the ability that it should be good to get a night's sleep. If you're thinking about the medium term, perhaps 6 months or a year away, something like that, then perhaps it makes sense to put your money in some bonds or some CDs, just because you want to get a little bit higher interest, but you know you don't need the money right away, so you might as well get a little bit of extra interest while you're doing it. On the other hand, if it's medium term, you probably don't want to risk the possibility that the stock market may collapse in the next year. And, for example, if I was thinking about buying a car 2 years from now or something like that, I might not want to take the risk that money just vanishes on me or drops substantially before that time. If you're thinking about the long term, though, you're thinking about more than 10 years, you're thinking about 25 years, you're thinking about 30, 40 years to retirement, then there's really only one bit of advice. That is, put the money all in a stock market mutual fund. Because over that long-term horizon, it's going to pay off for you. Now, I'm not saying that over the short term you won't see some big ups and big downs, some big jumps and some big falls. But over a 25 or 30 year horizon, if you go back looking at financial data to, you know, as far back as we've got it in the U.S. to about 1820, over any 10, 15, 20 year period, it's always better to put your money in stocks than it is to put it in alternate investments. And yes, that is even true if you put all your money in stocks in 1928, just before the Great Depression. Sure, things look pretty bad for you in 1930, 1931, 1932, but you hold on to that for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and you would still be happy that you would put your money in stocks in 1928 instead of putting it somewhere else. It does pay off over a period of a couple of decades. So when we think about time horizons, think about what do you want to use the money for, where are you thinking about spending that money, what point in time, and then choose your investment tool accordingly. Now, let me bounce back to a question that I sort of dodged a moment ago. And the question I dodged a moment ago was, why buy these funds of bonds? Why buy these funds of stocks? Why don't we just pick the stocks which are going to go up the most? After all, you know, why are we just sort of randomly going out there and buying a whole lot of things in a fund? Why not figure out which stocks are going to go up a lot and just pick those particular stocks? After all, that would clearly be the way to make the most money. And you probably all had the feeling, or I've certainly had the feeling, where you look in the paper someday and they say, oh, well, there's this company, and if you had just bought stock in that company 5 years ago, 10 years ago, wow, you know, your money would have gone up by a factor of 20 or something like that. And you think, boy, I just should have done that. The question is, why not do that? Why not pick the company that's going to go up a lot and put your money in that company? Seems like a simple strategy. Well, There's several answers to that question. Perhaps the simplest answer is, if I knew which companies were going to go up by that much in the next 5 or 10 years, I wouldn't tell you. And I mean that in quite an honest way. Why would I give away information of that value? I can't think of any conceivable reason why I would choose this moment to share that information with you. I would instead go out and I would put all my money in that company and I wouldn't tell anybody. And I mean that, it's partly a joke, but it's actually quite serious. In fact, if anybody comes to you and says, oh, I've got this wonderful idea for your money, it'll make 20 times your money, you know, just pay me a little bit and I'll tell you all about it, I think what you have to say to yourself is, if it's really that great an idea, you should be putting all of your money in it and there's no reason you should be telling me about it. It would be foolish to tell me about it. Why have this great opportunity ruined by all these people pouring money into it? So when you think about the question of, you know, how do I figure out what these stocks are, the short answer is, you know, don't listen to anyone who gives you advice about that. There's no reason that they should know, and there's no reason they should tell you if they do know. More seriously, or perhaps at a more intellectual level, there's good reason to believe that no one actually knows very well what the good stocks are going to be in the future. And this goes back to the theory, which was the title of that book by Malkiel, the theory of the random walk in stock markets. Now, random walk is a mathematical term in this context, and what it simply means is that a pathway where the fact that you've taken a step in one direction doesn't tell you anything about whether the next step goes one way or the other. The image people sometimes use of random walk is of someone who's very drunk, and they're simply taking steps, and the fact that they took a step to the right doesn't tell you anything about whether their next step will be to the right or the left. Now, the argument is that stock prices are a random walk. The fact that a stock price has gone up or down yesterday doesn't tell you anything about whether it's going to go up or down tomorrow. Now, why is it that stock prices might be a random walk? Well, to think about that, we need to think about what determines a stock price. What stands behind a stock price? What makes stock price what it is? Well, presumably, the reason that people buy stock in companies is because they think the company is going to make money. And in fact, the stock price of a company is going to represent the present discounted value of the future profits that you expect that company to earn. If you expect the company to earn really high profits and be a very profitable company, then the stock price is going to be high. If you expect the company not to earn very much in the way of future profits, then the stock price is going to be low. So, now back to our problem. How do we choose the companies which are going to go up a lot in value? Presumably what we want to do is pick a company where right now everybody thinks they're not going to earn much money in the future, so their stock price is low. But we know that everybody else is wrong. And what will actually happen is that they'll earn high profits in the future and the stock price is going to go up. and then everyone will change their mind and pay more for the stock. And you put the story in that way, it becomes a little more complicated. What we're really saying is, you have to predict how everyone else is going to change their mind. That's a tricky business. And in fact, the reason people are going to change their mind, probably, is that new things are going to come out. New news, new information about the company, new facts, new products, different things like that. And you don't have any way of predicting any better than anybody else what those things are. So when those unexpected things happen, and they have to be unexpected because all the expected things are already part of the stock market price, as the unexpected things happen, the stock market price is going to be jumping up and down and up and down. It's going to be moving like a random walk. The problem then becomes for the average person is, can you beat the news? Can you in advance predict what people are going to think tomorrow? And I think for the average person, the answer is clearly no. And if you think about it again for a moment, it really is clearly no. You have to remember that there are highly paid professionals making hundreds of thousands of dollars who are spending 16 hours a day at tables around the world, in London, in Hong Kong, in New York, all over the world, looking at news the instant it appears and making judgments based on sophisticated computer models. What you're really saying when you say, I can outguess those people, I can predict things ahead of them, is you're going to move faster than they are. You're going to get the news ahead of them. And that's just silly. That's ridiculous. There was a comment a few years ago that I remember from a fellow who was head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, one of the government offices which prints a lot of the government statistics. And he said that he got called up by some investors at some point, and they wanted to know if they could get the information from the Bureau of Labor Statistics faster. They could show up at their doorsteps faster. And he said, well, actually, yeah, there's a way to do that. We've got this electronic service. And so you just dial into the electronic service and, you know, boom, you have the information right away. He said, well, it turns out they already had the electronic service. They were complaining the electronic service took a minute. And they wanted to get it faster than a minute. Now, if you're somebody who's doing something like reading the Wall Street Journal in the morning or watching the cable news network, you just need to remember that information yesterday came over the wires. You may be seeing it today, but that information is old news as far as the financial markets are concerned. It's not only old news, it's ancient news. It's ancient history from the point of view of what's moving the market. And so you're trying to use old news to guess about the future, and that is not a winning thing to do in the market. In fact, one of the few ways you can really lose money in the stock market is to do what you sometimes hear about people doing, where they sign up with one of these services and they start trying to buy and sell stock five different times a day. And they listen to the news story and they say, oh my word, you know, I see a story about the Mideast. That probably means oil prices will go up. I'll buy some Exxon. And they race off and they do that. And then later on the day, oh, I think I'll sell that. And they jump off again. Well, if you buy and sell every day, each time you're paying a little commission, a little bit. And if you're doing it every day, those little bits, those little commissions add up. And in fact, you can easily end up losing money, even though the overall stock market is going up, because you're buying and selling and trying to time things in a way which just isn't going to work out very well. So buying these mutual funds is, for, I think, your average investor, really the only right solution. The notion that you're going to second guess and double guess and, you know, beat out the people who are running hundreds of millions of dollars for the state of California pension fund is just not very likely to happen. In fact, let me push this whole line of argument just a little bit further. When this first theory of the random walk came out, people were worried, or people were sort of incredulous. They were saying, now wait a second, are you really saying that if it's a random walk, then if I just buy any random group of stocks, that I will do, you know, pretty well? That's really what it is, just buy a random group of stocks? Well, they decided to test this. And at Forbes magazine, they started what they called the dartboard fund. And the way the dartboard fund was run was that they put up the financial pages of the Wall Street Journal across the room, and the editor of Forbes magazine, Malcolm Forbes, stood across the room and threw darts at the paper, and they bought any stock that they hit a dart. Dartboard fund. And then they said, well, if this theory is true, which we doubt, if this theory is true, then we would expect this dartboard fund to do as well as the market. And in fact, the dartboard fund over the last 25 years has done better than the market. It's done better because they bought a wide range of stocks, and sure, some of them went broke, but others did extremely well. It was just random luck that it did better. But on average, you pick a random group of stocks, if you pick a big group, on average, it ought to do about what the market does. It is a frightening fact that Burton Malkiel brings out in his Random Walk Down Wall Street that more than half of the money managers earn less than the average market return. And they earn less than the average market return because they're always buying and selling stock and paying commissions. And if you're buying and selling and paying commissions, that's going to cost you money as opposed to just buying it and holding it for a long period of time. Now, at this point, it's really common for people to say, well, what about this guy I heard about? This guy who runs this fund. And this fund, oh, it's just a great fund. You know, year after year, it's made more money. You go back 10 years, you go back 20 years, you know, every year he's done better than the market. How do you think about examples like that? Because there clearly are examples like that in the real world of people who've run very successful investment funds over long periods of time. Well, the way economists sort of think about things like that is like this. Imagine that you had a really, really large group of people, all the people in a football stadium, say, and you have them all flip coins. They all flip a coin, and you say, okay, everyone who gets ahead, stand up, everyone else sit down. Flip a coin again. Everyone who gets ahead, keep standing up, everybody else sit down. Flip a coin again. So you just keep flipping coins until eventually, at the end of this, you've got maybe three people standing up in the whole stadium. And those people might have flipped heads 10, 15, 20 times in a row. Would you go to those people and say, wow, you are an incredibly good coin flipper. You are like the best head flipper we've got. You know, what wonderful stuff. How do you do it? What's your technique for flipping coins to get heads over and over? No, of course you wouldn't say that. You would say, hey, it's a very large group of people. It's a very large group of people, and in a very large group of people, some people, by random chance, are going to get heads 10 or 15 times in a row. So when you think about people who manage funds of money, the real question is not, are there a few people who do well? Of course there are a few people who do well. There are a few people in the stadium who can flip heads 10 or 15 times in a row. The interesting question is, are there more people than you would expect according to random chance? Are there more people who make a lot of money in the market than you would expect by random chance? And the answer is no. If you look at the universe of how many investment advisors there are, say more than half of them do less than the average of the market, and a very, very small number do better year after year after year. And the small number is completely predictable by the fact that according to random chance, a certain number should do that well year after year. So, this dartboard fund, this idea of how to make money that way, is, I think, really worth belief, at least if you're an average investor. I'm not saying that if you're one of these really clever people who sits by a computer 16 hours a day, you can't sometimes figure out what's happening and take a little edge and catch up on something. But if you're your average person sitting at home, give up on it. I mean, it's really not worth your time or energy, and you're more likely to lose money than to make it. So, if we had to give simple advice about making money in the stock market, what we would tend to say is diversify, pick out a broad group of things, don't try and pick individual things, and most of all, get started as soon as you can. Now, I said before that sometimes you have to worry a little bit that, you know, you can't really get started if you're already in your 60s or something like that. But, you know, if you're someone who's in your 30s or your 40s or your early 50s, you have to think to yourself, hey, life expectancies these days probably mean that, you know, I'll be around till I'm 85 or 90. Unless there's something in your family history or your health patterns that makes you believe otherwise. So even if you're in your 40s or your early 50s, you have to think, my time horizon here really should be not just trying to retire at age 52, but it should be, what am I going to live on when I'm 70, when I'm 75, when I'm 80? Several decades off in the future. And on that sort of a schedule, when you look several decades off in the future, it's always going to make sense to put your money in a diversified stock fund and let the power of compound interest work for you.